This podcast is part of the Podcast Arcade Network.
Mega, making Eternia great again! I am Eddie, Prince of Daydream Destruction Manual and defender of the Podcast Arcade. This is Carl, my goat-kicking friend. Fabulous secret powers were revealed to me the day I held aloft my magic microphone and said, by the power of podcasts, I have the power!
I have the power too!
Carl became the mighty Goat Kicker, and I became E-Man, the most podcasty man in the universe! Only three others share this secret. Our friends, the Podcastress, Jeff at Arms, and Dorko. Together we defend the Podcast Arcade from the evil forces of boredom. Mega!
Welcome to Make Eternia Great Again. I'm your co-host, Eddie.
And I'm Jeff.
And we're lucky, Jeff.
We're very lucky.
How lucky can we get? I used to say if it wasn't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all.
That's right.
That's done.
That's all.
I'm finished. You announced this to me when we were in the thick of Grand Comic Con.
Yes.
We were hanging out with Andy
Mangles.
Mangles. And having a great time with him. Yep. And you come over wide-eyed. You're like, I just reached out to Tom Cook.
That's right.
We have Mr. Tom Cook. And as far as this podcast is concerned, but more than this, but one of the main animators of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
That's right. And She-Ra.
And She-Ra.
And no, so I mean, many more.
We're going to get into
and
it.
So many more. We'll get into that. But we want to introduce Mr. Tom Cook. Thanks for coming to the show.
Hey, thank you for inviting me.
So, Tom, if you wouldn't mind, maybe you've had a long, illustrious career doing so many projects. However you want to, you know, kick things off, you want to talk about that a little bit or give a little background or, but ultimately I think people just really want to hear, you know, more about you and how you got to Filmation.
Yeah, sure. What I usually start out with, I was about 8 years old when Marvel Comics came out, and I was camping in the backyard with my next door neighbor, you know, in a tent pitched in the backyard and with the flashlights reading comic books. And I had all these DC Comics, and my neighbor pulls out this Spider-Man comic, and I'm like, what in the world is that? And it was Spider-Man number 4. So like I said, Marvel had just started. And so I traded him straight across. I gave him every DC comic I had for that Spider-Man 4. And I think he also had a Fantastic Four number 10, if I remember correctly. But that's kind of what got me wanting to start to draw. I loved Spider-Man. I loved the way Steve Ditko posed him. You know, it always looked like such great action. And that's what got me wanting to draw. So, you know, fast forward, I'm working at a place called RTD, the Rapid Transit District. I'm about 23 years old, and I've got a job driving the transit buses in Los Angeles. And ironically, my route, part of the time, went up across from the San Fernando Valley into Hollywood, passing the Hanna-Barbera building. And I'd go by the building a couple, two, three times a day. It was one of my days off, and I was making lunch, and the mail had come. So I went out and got the mail, and it was just a bunch of junk mail. And now, normally, I just threw the junk mail right in the trash. For some reason this day, I put it on my countertop in the kitchen. And when I sat down to eat my sandwich, I noticed this little pamphlet, and it was a college extension course schedule for the summertime. So I wasn't really interested in it, but I just thought, what the heck, I'll just read something while I'm sitting here eating. And I started thumbing through it, and I came to this comic book class that was being taught in the summer. And the guy who was teaching it is a guy named Don Rico. Now, Don Rico worked on Captain America and the Daredevil that was kind of like half black and half red. And so I said, you know, gosh, I want to take this class. You know, number one, I wanted to learn more about how comic books were made. But number two, I wanted to meet this guy that worked in comic books. So I signed up for the class, and the first day he said, okay, we want you to bring your portfolio in the following week so we can see, you know, what type of stuff you like to do. And so I brought my portfolio in. It was all superheroes. You know, it was all Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom and, you know, all that stuff. And so after the class, he kind of said, hey, Tom, can I talk to you for a second? And at first I thought, gosh, what did I do wrong? You know, I'm already in trouble. But he said, look, I am a storyboard artist at Hanna-Barbera. And we're working on a new show called Challenge of the Super Friends. And we have a lot of people that can draw Fred and Barney and Scooby-Doo, but they're not really very good with the human figure. And we like, I like your superhero drawings. And I was wondering if you would like to be recommended for a class that teaches basic animation over at the Hanna-Barbera Studios. It's every Thursday night. It's free, but you have to be recommended by somebody, and I would like to recommend you. So, of course, I said, no, no, thank you very much, but I want to be a bus driver for the rest of my life. No. So anyway, I just said, of course I want to do that. So I got into this class and started the following Thursday. And it was maybe two or 3 hours in the evening on Thursday. And there were about 30, 35 people in the class. So I sat down and started doing my first in-between, which I didn't even know what that was, you know, because even though I was a fan of animation, I really wasn't that aware of how it was made. And so I did my first in-between. It took me like, you know, two of the days of the class when it should take you like 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm just learning. And so after the third week, the one of the directors said, hey, we're going to hire four people out of this class. And I was one of the four. So, I mean, my jaw just hit the floor when they said my name. And so now I've got this quandary because I've got a bus driver job. And I'm making good money. It's a union job. I've got full benefits. And they're hiring me to work at Hanna-Barbera where I know nothing. You know, I've done one in between. I don't feel like I'm that qualified to be able to.
That's a pretty big leap into your dream, though, too. Right. So,
yeah, exactly. So what I did is the people at the bus company knew that I was doing this. So they were kind of rooting for me. They said, look, just take a leave of absence for like 3 months from the company.
Oh, that's awesome.
What?
Yeah. So I said, okay, that's what I'll do. So I went back to the director and I told him, I said, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. He said, don't worry. You're going to sit with an animator. You're going to be his assistant. So I started as an assistant animator. And what I did basically is the animator made the characters move, but he would only draw them like every fifth drawing. And then it was my job to clean up his blue pencil drawings and make them really clean and look like the character, and then do the in-betweens to fill out the action. And after about 2 or 3 weeks, the animator I was working with said, you know, you're picking this up really fast. So I thought, okay, that's a good sign. So I went ahead and went into my bus driver people and said, you know, I think I'm going to quit. I'm going to just go ahead and take the full-time job at Hanna-Barbera. So that's kind of how I got started. And it's talk about a dream come true without even trying to dream it. You know, it was just completely, I could have thrown that junk mail in the trash and never seen that catalog.
No kidding.
But because I did, yeah, it changed my whole life.
No shit. That's incredible. I'm throwing junk mail away every single day. What am I doing?
Go to your garbage right now. Get your garbage.
Yeah, no kidding.
Tom, so like, I mean, talk about listening to that inner voice. I mean, like you said, you were kind of just passive about reading it while you munched on your sandwich. Put me in that 23-year-old's brain. The day before that, were you even thinking about art? Or were you kind of like in a weird that beginning 23-year-old place where you don't know what you're doing with yourself? Like, where were you at right before that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was going to college and, you know, just taking morning classes because I had to work full time. I had gotten married really young and it didn't work out. So I still had alimony payments, et cetera, to pay at 23. And so it was always something that was a dream that someday I could maybe work on Spider-Man or. But I knew that wasn't ever going to happen because, especially back at that time, you had to live in New York to be a comic book artist. And to be quite frank with you, I really wasn't interested in drawing backgrounds, and I like drawing what I like to draw, and it wasn't necessarily what was going to be in a comic book. And as far as the animation part of it, I wouldn't have even known where to start to try to get a job at animation. I mean, it was so foreign to me. Although I was a huge fan of like the early Hanna-Barbera stuff with Yogi Bear, Huckleberry Hound, Quick Draw, that eventually Top Cat, and then and the Flintstones. I mean, the Flintstones was great. I used to sit as a kid and watch every time Fred turned his head a certain direction, I'd draw as much as I could. And so I learned to draw Fred just by looking at the TV show. And I mean, this isn't reruns of the TV show. This is the first showing of the TV show. So I'm about 9 or 10. And ironically, the very first drawing I ever did at Hanna-Barbera was of Fred Flintstone.
Wow. That's awesome. So,
and I had them take the drawing that I did, the very first drawing of the scene that I was working on. I took it down and they Xeroxed it onto a cell. They had one of the cell painters paint it for me, and they gave me a background of Flintstones, and that is up in my studio today. So I've got the very first drawing I ever did.
That's incredible. That's goosebump worthy right there. I got goosebumps. That's amazing. Holy smokes. That's so cool.
Man. That's kind of what I'm like. I mean, I collected everything. You know, I had a huge comic book collection, and I've got tons of like toys and of a lot of the shows that I've worked on. And I've always collected it throughout my career. And, you know, I've recently gone out and purchased some things that I never had the interest in. But now that I've been doing this, you know, at this con circuit for the last 5 or 6 years, I find I've got my studio set up and I've just got shelves full of, you know, He-Man Sokies and a lot of toys that came out that I never bothered purchasing when I was in my 20s.
It's funny you're kind of telling this side of it because, I can only speak. Jeff and I have a very similar backstory on how we came into some of this stuff. And so here we were, you know, 7, 8 years old when we got turned on. Well, I was probably a little younger. I was probably about 6 when I got turned on to He-Man. And like kind of how you described Spider-Man, it was a instant. Like, oh my gosh.
Gravitation, yeah.
I want to be part of this. I want this in my life as much as possible. Right. And it's just funny how that kind of keeps like that rhythm of sharing that passion for that thing kind of continues on, you know?
Well, this is part of the reason why I think anyway, I can really relate to the fans because I had the same experience, but just with different things.
Right.
And so when somebody comes up to me, and I'll tell you, it's really weird, but when somebody comes up to me and says, oh, Mr. Cook, you're a legend, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I just laugh because I'm not a legend. I'm just the guy that worked on these shows.
Yeah.
But it's the cartoons that I worked on that are legendary.
That's right.
And,
yeah.
But I understand that because when I go to meet, like when I first met Jack Kirby, it was like he was my legend.
Right.
And he told me, he says, I'm not a legend. I'm just the guy that draws comics. So right. we never think we're legends. It's only the fans that make us legends. Yeah. But being a fan myself, I can put my feet in the shoes of the person that's standing on the other side of my table meeting me. And so it's really good because I have this, because I've worked with people that, you know, was just a job to them. They didn't really care for the cartoons. They hated the place we worked. You know, it's like that everywhere. That, you know, some people just don't like what they're doing, but they just happen to be talented and do it.
Right.
And the opposite for me, I was just like, my gosh, I can't believe that I'm sitting here drawing freaking He-Man.
Yes.
That's awesome. So when about in your career would you say that, you know, you're talking about how you like started off with the Flintstones and stuff like that. When about in your career would you say that all of a sudden you're like, okay, I don't need to pinch myself anymore. This is real. I'm in the throes of it and I'm loving it. Like when about was that?
I don't know if I ever got to that point because I always loved the fact of how lucky I was in getting into what I did. And you know, when I do my, I do a panel at some of the shows and I go through a lot of the things that I've worked on. And I mean, it's just gigantic. Yeah. I mean, I was everywhere I turned, I worked on something that was incredible.
Yeah.
And stuff wasn't as incredible, but it still was, you know, it kept me going until I got to the stuff that was incredible. Right. And I was basically, you know, I started in 78. And at that point, it was Challenge of the Super Friends, Scooby and Scrappy Show, Flintstones, something called the Shmoo. There was something called the Thing, which was the Fantastic Four thing, but it wasn't really the Fantastic Four. It was a kid that found a ring, and it would turn him into the Thing. And so those are the things I was working on early on. But I was an assistant animator, so I was cleaning up the animator's artwork and doing the in-betweens.
Yeah.
Now, about this was the rough part of the business, and I didn't really realize this when I first started. At the end of the year, you get laid off because they have to wait to find out what the networks are going to purchase for the next series they want to do, or if they're going to renew the show that you just got done working on. So we'd finish about September, October. And so we'd be off like November, December, January. And so you had to save your money to be able to make it through those 3 months. And then around February, you'd start calling all the studios, because there were three or four different TV studios. The Patty Freeling, Hanna-Barbera, Ruby Spears, Filmation, and a few other ones. And so you would call the different studios and said, hey, I'm looking for work. Have you guys started up yet?
Yeah.
And then you started getting the, okay, call us in 2 weeks. And then you would get, what I did is I was laid off at Hanna-Barbera and I started calling and I contacted Ruby Spears and they said, you know, we're starting up. So yeah, we need some assistant animators. What have you worked on? You know, I showed them my portfolio and got hired with Ruby Spears. Now, this was in 1980. So I've been in the business a couple of years. Now, I was still an assistant, but this is where I got to work on Heathcliff the Cat, Plastic yes. Man, Rickety Rocket, Thundar the Barbarian.
Ooh.
And yeah, that was my favorite, was Thundar. I thought that was the best show that I'd ever worked on as a storyline.
Eddie and I have been high-fiving all ever since he's done Thundar.
I saw you worked on Thundar, and I started to – I fell on my knees and wept.
Yeah, so – and see, this is where all of a sudden I'm in the building, and I see Jack Kirby. And I'm going, holy crap, that's Jack Kirby. And I had met him once before. I went to a autograph signing that he had at the local bookstore. And because he lives, you know, 15, 20 minutes away from where I lived. So here comes Jack Kirby. And I go, oh, my gosh, it's Jack Kirby. And everybody in our room said, who's Jack Kirby?
What?
Because I was with cartoon people.
Right.
That they knew Bob Clampett and Chuck Jones. But they wouldn't know Jack Kirby because I was a comic book guy. So I ran over and pretended I had to go to the other side of the building so I could accidentally run into him. And so I just said, oh, my gosh, it's Jack Kirby, blah, blah, blah. You know, and he puts his portfolio down and he spends like 15 minutes talking to me. And he gives me, I mean, listen to this. He gives me his phone number and his address. And he says, come on over to the house. This is Jack Kirby.
Holy smokes.
What?
So I'm just, yeah. So I'm just like, you guys are going nuts, right?
Yeah.
So that's how I got to meet Jack Kirby. I didn't realize he was working at Ruby Spears and he was one of the designers on Thundar.
That's
so
incredible.
Steve Gerber, who was the creator of Howard the Duck, he kind of co-created Thundar. And so immediately, you know, I started working on that show and I just loved it.
I couldn't imagine ever being bored working on that show.
Yeah, it was the ultimate. And of course, you know, with Ookla the Mock, nobody realizes that Ookla, even though it's spelled OOKLA, it really stands for UCLA, the college.
Oh,
that's funny.
Didn't know that.
No clue.
That's incredible.
But he called that Ookla. And it was like, no. So they made the character named Ookla and just changed the spelling of it.
That's cool. It took me forever as a kid to realize that the Mock wasn't his name.
Yeah. Mr. The Mock.
Yeah. It's like Chewbacca the Wookiee.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So now I'm still an assistant, and it's right about this time that the union, the Motion Picture Screen Cartoonist Guild, we decide as a group to go on strike for more money. And I'm completely against this because we're making big time money anyway. And I realize prior to working as a bus driver, I worked at General Motors welding cars together on the assembly line. And I lost my job because the union wanted more money. So they closed the plant, sent it to Canada.
Right.
So I've already experienced losing a great job through the union. And so the union starts talking about, you know, they want double what we're making. And I mean, we're talking, you know, the 1980, and we're making like 17, 18 bucks an hour.
Whoa, 80s money.
Yeah,
which crazy. Was, you know, that's like making 50, 60 bucks now.
Right.
So I said, look, I want to get, I don't care if we get a raise. Let's get rid of that October, November, December being laid off crap.
Right.
And get so that we get work throughout the year. And that way, that's what our raise will be. We'll make more money per year just based on that. And most of the union people, you know, just no, we just need money, blah, blah, blah. So we went on strike, and Hanna-Barbera, Ruby Spears, all of the companies sent all of the work to Japan and Korea. Bingo, we had no job.
Yeah, smooth move, guys.
Now, I was smart enough because I didn't believe Ruby Spears was telling us, you know, that they bought this brand new building, and they were saying, oh, we bought this building. Why would we do this if we got this huge? Well, they were lying. You could tell the way they were talking.
Yeah.
So I had heard that Lou Scheimer at Filmation had said, I will never send work overseas. We're doing the work here because this is an American art form and we should not send it somewhere else. So as soon as I heard that, I called up a buddy of mine that was working at Filmation, and that's how I got hired over at Filmation.
Oh, wow.
And they had grown, and their main studio was too small, so they had grown and bought some other buildings or rented some other buildings around the San Fernando Valley. And I was working over in what they called Filmation West. And this is where they Shazam and ISIS, the live action shows.
Yep.
So I was, you know, I was stuck out on this sound stage with all these fake rocks around me with my animation desk. and I was working on Flash Gordon and Tarzan.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, those are the first two things I did over at Filmation. Well, and I'm, you know, I'm still an assistant animator, but I have been doing in the evening when I get home. I had my own animation desk at home. And I would sit and draw and try my own animation. Nice. And, you know, learning how to make things move and make it look real and all that sort of stuff. And then I would bring it in and I would shoot it on their video camera and then show the directors. Say, hey, look, this is what I did. In the hopes that they would say, okay, we'll hire you as an animator now. So it was really difficult because being at Filmation West, I was like, 5 or 10 miles away from the main studio where all the directors and all the animators were. That's where all the assistants were, was at Filmation West. Well, the lady that ran the assistant department came to me and said, Tom, she says, I know that you want to become an animator, and it's going to be really hard to do it from here. So we need to have somebody, an assistant animator over at the main studio that can do fixes. So they don't have to keep sending the work back for the assistants to fix. She said it's going to be a kind of a crappy job. You're not going to like it. You're going to be fixing other people's animation and other people's assistant work. But this will give you a chance to get to know the directors and show them your stuff. So I said, okay, you know, I'll do that. And so they sent me over to the main studio, And that's what I did. You know, if an assistant had goofed up, would bring the work to me instead of having to ship it over to the other studio again, and I would fix it. But after a month or two of doing that, I had shown the directors enough work, and they said, okay, I think you're ready to be an animator now. So I was hired as an animator, and the first show I ever worked on as an animator was Black Star.
Yes! Again!
Exactly. So, I mean, I was thrilled to death. And so the whole plan had worked. You know, Doris Plow was the name of the assistant, head of the assistants. And I give her a lot of credit because she kind of did this for me. She didn't have to. But she saw that I was, you know, desired to be an animator. And so now, so we're working on Black Star. And I mean, look, I can animate stuff, but I'm very slow because I'm just learning this part of it now. I got to be a really good So we go through Black Star, and now they're talking about doing a second season of Black Star. And whatever the network is, NBC or ABC or CBS, whatever that was on, they wanted to do a second season of Black Star, but they wanted to cut the budget. And one of the things about Black Star is we had a lot of special effects. And they didn't want to eliminate the special effects. So they said, you know, I think we're not going to do a second season. We'll just try to find something else to fill in the spaces. And we were kind of upset about it, but we didn't realize that He-Man was in the works. Black Star, or actually any TV show that was done for ABC, CBS, and NBC, and then eventually Fox, a normal season is like 13 episodes.
Right.
And that way they could play the episodes like four or five times and then go on to, and that's a full season. So now suddenly with He-Man, we found out we're going to have to do five episodes a week.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Oh, gosh.
Monday through Friday. So now instead of doing 13 episodes for a season, we're doing 65 episodes.
Well, you wanted to work so more.
Yeah, from that point on, I never got laid off again.
Yeah.
So it really, really was great. And if not for Lou Scheimer, I probably would have gone back to driving a bus because there was no work in the United States.
That's crazy. You know, so Filmation literally was a thing for you to keep doing the thing that you realized you loved.
Right. And Disney, you could work at Disney, but it was really hard to get in. It was very political, and they didn't pay as much as the TV side did. So, you know, although we all would have loved to have worked on the Disney feature films, but remember, this is back before Little Mermaid and Roger Rabbit. So it was really right. The ones that weren't very good. They had gone right. Downhill quite a bit.
Yeah.
So we didn't really desire to work on that. And me having the comic book thing going, I mean, working on He-Man and Black Star, I mean, that was my ballpark right there.
Right.
So anyway, so we're working on He-Man, and, you know, it just changed everybody's life. You know, suddenly we had so much work, we couldn't believe it. Anybody that was in the animation business was working at Filmation because there was no other studio to work at. And that's when I finally started to get better as an animator. You know, everywhere I went, I was looking at how people moved, and even you would get things like a scene where it's raining or something and water's hitting the ground and splashing up, and you had to figure out how to make that look real.
Yeah.
So I'd be in the rain looking at the sidewalks and seeing how the water's splashing, and so you're really cognizant of your surroundings and looking at everything to see how a flag waves in the air. And because if you've never done it before, you don't know until you test it, you know, until you try.
Reference. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I found out because there's a lot of people that are terrific assistant animators that never go on to become an animator because they just can't understand how to move things and make it look real. And again, I was lucky, and I had the ability to do that.
What was it like in the early 80s when He-Man, early mid-80s, when He-Man was kind of at its peak? Not just He-Man, but She-Ra as well. What was it like walking around stores and seeing toys and coloring, all this stuff come out of art that you helped create. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was very humbling because working on Super Friends and Scooby-Doo, there's always stuff in the stores, but it wasn't like He-Man. This was over the top, gigantic. And you couldn't go. And this was really the first show. I'd go out with people to dinner or whatever, and it would eventually come around to, what do you do for a living? And then they get to me and I'd say, well, I'm an animator. And they kind of go, well, what is that? We don't know what that is. I'd say, well, I work on, TV shows and stuff. And even if I said Thundar and Heathcliff, they still didn't quite get what I was doing.
Right.
But as soon as I said, and I was an animator on He-Man, all of a sudden I was like, holy crap, my kids love that.
Yeah.
My kids love that show, and we had to buy them all the toys and blah, blah. So all of a sudden, I was the star of the dinner party.
Yeah.
And I didn't go around saying, hey, I worked on He-Man. I waited until somebody asked me what I did because I don't like going around bragging about yourself,
You don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, exactly. And if they never asked, I never said.
Right.
But plus, one of the good things is that I can walk around and have dinner and not be bothered because nobody knows who the heck I am.
Right.
So that's nice, too.
Stuff a bus driver doesn't have to worry about. No shade to bus drivers, just saying.
Yes, exactly.
It's funny. I was talking about, when we started this podcast, it was born out of us just kind of reminiscing about being that age and what kind of magic it meant to us when we were that age. And it felt like our thing because, we were both born in the late 77, 78. And so things like Star Wars and Spider-Man and Superman, these things had existed without us. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so when He-Man popped up, it authentically, especially as a kid, it authentically felt like ours, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's your TV show.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was one of those kids. TV was kind of a rare thing. So I came into it through the toys first. And then within a month was made aware of the cartoon. And at that point, it was just a matter of me sprinting home after school as fast as I could so I wouldn't miss the opening. And it's just one of those things. You don't realize for you, I guess, anybody, but realize how many lives you touch when you are creating something that has that kind of, pardon the pun, power to it,
Yeah. And I'll tell you, I never... Look, all I did was know how Spider-Man impacted me, but it still felt like maybe only me. I mean, I knew other people liked it too, but it was so big to me that I never realized that it was just as big to other people.
Yeah.
And with He-Man, it was kind of the same thing. I knew people were watching it. I mean, it was getting such great reviews and was getting great ratings and everything else. The toys were just flying off the shelves. So we knew that. But what happened is people said to me, they go, a lot of times they'll say, what's your favorite episode of He-Man? I go, all right, now what was I doing at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when it was on?
Yeah.
I was working on the show.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
I didn't really at first run. I had to wait till VHS tapes came out. Then I could see some episodes. The only episodes I ever saw in full was The Secret of the Sword. And that was because we had a special screening at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood.
That's awesome.
And
yeah.
I'm going to be doing an interview, I think it's a Facebook interview or something on Sunday. And I've got some of the tickets from that. Because like I said, I kept kind of everything.
Yeah.
And so I've got tickets to that. And I've got, when we moved to a new studio, I've got the little card that said, hey, we're moving. And it had all the characters on it and stuff. Filmation was a really fun place to work because Lou Scheimer was a kid himself. I mean, he loved this stuff. And at Hanna-Barbera were more businessmen, and Lou had actually been a background painter, so he had experienced the animation part of things. And he was just a great boss, and I mean, literally saved all of our lives, because if not for Filmation, I would have had to go back to being a bus driver, because I never would have. And then after Filmation finally closed in like 89, we thought we were out of the business. And one of my friends and I went down to Mary Tyler Moore Studios. It's a live action studio. Yeah. It used to be Desi Lou, owned by Lucille Ball.
Yeah.
And this is where they filmed like New Heart and a lot of TV series. And we had heard that one of our friends that was a maintenance guy at Filmation was working at MTM Studios, just sweeping up. But we needed work. And yeah. So we decided to just go over there and see if we could meet him. And then we figured we had talent. We'd, you know, end up being a grip or a camera assistant and kind of work our way up the ladder, even if we had to push a broom for the first couple of months. And we went over there and we had to sneak onto the studio because they had a gate with guards. And we noticed that they weren't checking anybody's badges. So we went and got ourselves brown paper sacks like we were coming back from lunch. And we just walked out without anybody bothering us.
That's amazing.
That's very like Muppety of you guys.
you could never do that today.
But luckily we
walked in the front gate, and within 5 minutes we ran into this guy that we knew. So he came up to us. He says, "Hey, do you guys work at that studio across the street?" And we kind of looked at each other like, "What studio across the street?" And he points to the building and he says, "That building right there, there's a guy that used to work at Disney started his own studio." And we thought maybe you were working over there. And we said, "No, we didn't even know about that studio." And he said something about this guy named Jeff Patch is the one that's hiring people over there. Well, my buddy says, "I know Jeff Patch." So we go walking over to that building and we go in the lobby and we ask what floor this studio is on. And we get in there and there's Jeff Patch sitting there, and he says, "Are you guys looking for work?" And we said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh man, we're looking for some animators."
What?
The next day, I'm working on Roger Rabbit.
Holy smokes.
Gotta be kidding me.
Again, look at the luck here.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's like it's like you were just like going through a car wash of luck. Like
I have no reason to think that I'm responsible for my own career if everybody else has gotten me work.
Right.
And it even took place later on when in 1990, my mom passed away. And that was really the only reason I was staying in the Valley. LA had grown so crowded and busy and I just couldn't stand it anymore. And my best friend lived up in Seattle. So I moved up to Seattle. And I got a job at Microsoft, and same thing sort of happened. Somebody saw me selling cells of Scooby-Doo at a Comic-Con. I was just there as a vendor.
Yeah.
And he owned a comic store, and he said, "I want you to come to my comic store and I'll announce you and you can do autographs and stuff." And I said, "Nobody's going to come to see me in Seattle. It's just not okay. If you want to do it, I'll do it." And so he contacted the Seattle Times, and the Seattle Times came out and they did a whole article on me in the business section.
Yeah,
it was called "From Hollywood to Maple Valley," because that's the little town I lived in, was Maple Valley. And, you know, front page of this business section is a picture of me working at my desk, and they did a great interview. And next thing you know, I show up at this guy's comic store and I've got a line down the street of people that want to get my autograph.
Wow.
Yeah, so then he says, people kept asking me, you know, "Are you teaching an animation class? You know, we'd love to do an animation class." Well, at this point, I owned a comic book store. I just opened maybe a couple of months before I appeared at his store. And I said, "You know, if you guys are interested in an animation class, we can hold it at my at my store on like Thursday nights, and you guys could just drive up. And I made them animation desks and everything so that they could work. And we had like 20 plus students.
What?
And so somebody that lived in Seattle saw that article. Well, he was directing cartoons down in L.A., but living in Seattle. They would FedEx him the work. So he contacted me and he said, are you interested in directing some TV shows? And so I said, well, yeah, sure. So next thing you know, I'm directing Savage Dragon, King of the Hill, you know, all sorts of different shows. I even did an episode of The Simpsons. And so that kind of was another thing where if not for having that article, I probably never would have gotten the direction into things. And here I am in Seattle. How in the heck am I going to do any animation work? And yet, you know, that happened too. So, and that was kind of the end of it there. You know, the last thing I did was directing.
Yeah. Right. Yep. So how amazing is that, that, you know, I think at some point, like you're saying, you realize like, hey, this is a lot of luck. And it was really cool that you're very cognizant of that as you're going along saying, I'm on this crazy ride. I'm going to start keeping things to make sure that I always, you know, like you kept your movie tickets and all that other stuff. You know, that's really cool of you that you weren't just like, yeah, I deserve this. And
you about know, time.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, you know, I had the talent to be able to do it. But right. Like I said, I never had to go out. Well, early on I did. You know, when I was an assistant and we were getting laid off, that was the tough part because I really had to go out in every stinking studio, every lead, you know, to get work. It was when Filmation finally made it a full-time job that I no longer had to work as hard to get work. And so in that instance, the only reason I got the directing work is because I knew what I was doing. If I didn't know how to do it, I never would have gotten that.
Right.
But it's still through the series of things that happened that got me into the directing. And, you know, if it wasn't for that assistant animator head that gave me the opportunity to go over to the main studio, I might never have been an animator. So, I mean, it's, you know, I definitely throw out thanks to those people because, you know, without them seeing something in me and wanting to push me forward, I don't know if I would have done it on my own.
That's such a cool story.
What a time to be in it too.
No kidding.
So even to this day, do you find yourself sometimes, Tom, do you just like, will you get kind of draw stuff just for the sake of doing it? Or are you kind of like, you know, I've moved on? Or do you still so often just find yourself doodling He-Man characters for the sake of it?
Well, what I'm doing is I'm trying to make larger pieces. Because most of the stuff I do, people want to, can I get a sketch of He-Man? Okay, so I do sketch of He-Man, or I want Scooby-Doo, or I want, you know, Fred Flintstone. So I'm trying to do things that are a little bit more, I've got one I'm working on now. It's, I think it looks like it's 16 by 14. I think it's 16 by 14. And I've got like all the good guy characters from He-Man on one side, all the bad guys on the other side. There's Masters of the Universe in the middle, and it's got He-Man and Skeletor kind of fighting in the center. So it's a little bit more of a poster design kind of.
Yes.
But it's done in the animation style. And I'll take that with me to some Comic-Cons and once I get it done and, you know, put it up for sale and people can buy it. I did a poster of He-Man and all the good guys, and She-Ra and all of her friends, and then Skeletor and all the bad guys. And I've got like a three print set that I sell. And it's basically just their heads and shoulders. And they're all kind of looking in different directions. Somebody had done something similar to this online, but didn't do a very good job of it. And I said, you know, that's a clever idea. I get all the characters in one, you know, I guess it's 11 by 14. And that way the people can get, you know, all these characters in one drawing. And I did the originals and colored them and everything else and then made prints. So now I've got the prints that I sell at the show.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And that way, you know, the originals somebody bought, I was in New York City Comic-Con and somebody bought all three of them. But the price was higher.
Yeah, of course.
Sounds like $60 prints, autographed, and it's reasonable. Yeah. But they were like, you know, $300 a piece to get the actual original. So, but, you know, being 66, I'm kind of tired of drawing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see it.
But it comes and goes. Every now and then it's like, I'm real excited. Let's sit down and do something. Other times it's like, yeah, I think I'll watch TV.
Yeah. There you go. No, I get it.
So you obviously, like you mentioned, and I've been kind of following a little bit of your career as of late, you do a lot of conventions. Like, you're a busy man. And so is that something that you really like to do, or are you just kind of like, oh, I just ride this out to kind of pay the bills, or where do you sit with that?
No, I love doing the conventions. It's a real good opportunity to meet the people that are really responsible for the success of these shows. And being the kind of guy that I was with Spider-Man, and, you know, I went 2 years ago, I went down when I was in New York. I sought out Steve Ditko.
Nice.
And introduced myself to him and just told him that he was the inspiration for me beginning my entire career. And, you know, so that was really important to me to meet him. And he's very shy. He doesn't really want to talk or anything. But yet he took the time and shook my hand and said, I'm glad that you came and met me, you know, because I had influences in my life, and it's nice to know that I influenced yours. So, it's the same thing with me. You know, if you're a big He-Man fan, I was just a cog. You know, I was just one of the, you know, 40 animators or so that we had. But it's still a chance to meet somebody that was involved in what is your cartoon, like you said.
Right. Yeah.
And it's super fun. And, you know, I like, you know, when somebody commissions something, it's kind of fun to go back and do it. And, you know, and I keep my prices fairly low. I don't want to charge. I've got different price points, you know, starting at only $60 for a sketch. And I do everything in color. And I try to make it look like it's almost a cell, but done on paper.
Oh, nice.
You know, so they're. A lot of times they're poses straight from the model sheets, but they're those really classic poses that everybody knows.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and this is one of the things that somebody got mad at me, because I have a banner, and the banner has all the shows that I worked on, you know, different pictures of the characters and stuff.
Yeah.
And this is all stuff that are taken from promotional Filmation stuff, and you know, I was never a production artist that could go out and do everything and color it and make it look like a production piece. So I had taken the DVD cover of the Best of He-Man or something like that, and took the picture of He-Man off of it and stuck it on my banner. And the guy, you know, got really angry at me for taking, in quotes, his art. When really it was his, he really only traced the model sheets that I have and then kind of recolored them.
Right.
And I felt like, well, this is, he got paid for this job. You know, he did this for the DVD cover or whatever. And I just needed something on my banner. But he started getting really nasty to me. And it's been kind of a little bone of contention. And I told him, I said, look, you know, I don't agree. I think that if there's a, something from the DVD cover, I worked on the show. I should be able to use those images. Those are images right from the show. You know, if you got, say, Alan Oppenheimer, a good friend of mine, he's the guy that did Skeletor's voice.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, he sells a print of him as Skeletor. Well, he's not an artist.
Right.
Right.
He had to take a picture from the TV show, and that's the print that he signs. And it's like, that's not his art. It's somebody else's art. He was the voice of the character. I think he has the right to use, even if it was my art from the TV show, I was paid for that art. That was my job to produce the art. And so I kind of felt the same way. But I'm trying to be nice to the guy. And I don't like, you know, people bad mouthing me behind my back. So, you know, we've kind of come to you know, I'll say, I'll remove it. I'll remove it if it really bothers you that much. But I still disagree with them, but I just don't want, the bad press, so to speak.
Right.
You're taking the high road there for sure.
You're bringing up a good thing because, you know, I've known you for a while, like obviously not personally, but, you know, I have heard of this story, but I never heard your side. And I was like, as much as I've seen of what you post online and how you are as a person to your fans, the interviews that you've done, I'm just like, you know, there's always two sides to every story. And I'm so glad that we're able to hear your side, because I was like, you know, and Eddie and I have talked about this too. It was like, Tom comes across as a very genuinely nice person. And it's like, it doesn't seem like he would be of his character to blatantly try to hurt somebody or rip them off or whatever. And then, like you said, exactly. You're doing is you're taking, somebody took something of yours and is profiting off of it. And so why not you be able to just do the same thing? You know, it's like you're all sharing from the same group. It shouldn't matter of saying this is mine or this is mine, you know, so it doesn't really matter. But
I'm not, you know, with it being on my banner, it's just to allow fans that are walking up to me see that I worked on He-Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You copied my copy of what you made.
Right. You know, and I don't begrudge. He was hired to do that, and I'm sure they wanted it to look like the model sheets, so they just told him, trace the model sheets. It's real obvious he did, because the picture of Evil Lynn, she's got her hand kind of a really weird position, and the sorceress has her arms out. And I'm just telling you, I've got the model sheets right here, and they're just all redone by him, which is fine. I mean, we did that a lot in the show, where we were in such a hurry to get things done. It was like, just use as your first pose the model sheet.
Yeah.
And that way you didn't have to rack your brain to come up with a specific pose.
Right.
You could start with something that you could do really quickly and then work out of that.
Yeah.
And I know this is circling around, and that's one of the problems, is that people never get the other side of the story.
Yeah.
And, I was on the MOTU Nation or something like that. And within an instant, they started complaining, and bingo, I'm banned. It's like, I can't even tell people the real story.
Oh, that's incredible. I didn't know that.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And there's actually more to the story that's a little bit less kind to them, but I don't want to make life tough for them either. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, believe me, there's some stuff that's being said out there that is completely false. And yes, the part is true is that I did take the DVD cover and used it on my banner. And again, I just don't think that's a big deal, and they do. Like I said, the way I relate it is the same thing. I did all this work for Filmation, and other people are using it, but that's okay. I got paid for doing that artwork.
Right.
This guy got paid for doing the DVD cover, and I noticed, I was out online, and I found the same DVD cover for sale on canvases. You can get different size canvases made of his artwork. I don't know that he's getting paid for that.
Right.
Because he got paid like whatever, $1,000 to do the cover. Now it's the company's cover.
Right. Right. It's not his anymore.
Yeah.
Right. So other people are doing the same thing, and yet I felt like I'm being chastised and criticized for doing the same thing that everybody else is doing.
You know, it's funny you kind of mentioned that. And that's one thing, kind of one of the tenets of this podcast. Jeff and I produce some other podcasts as well. But the core tenet of this show is like we maintain a positive kind of fandom. And it's unfortunate when you run into I'm going to use the word, it's kind of a heavy word, but kind of toxic fandom, where it gets out of hand, and it gets like oddly backbitey and unnecessary. And it's like, we're all grown adults. Let's enjoy this for what it is and really be nice and rally behind it. Don't, like, this shouldn't be a thing that creates, pardon the pun, havoc, havoc staff. Get it?
South California. Yeah.
But I did want to ask you, what are some of your thoughts on kind of the resurgence of some of these IPs? Like, He-Man is starting. There's a new movie that's been announced. There's new toys,
The She-Ra cartoon.
The She-Ra cartoon on Netflix. Like, what are some of your thoughts on some of that?
Well, I mean, I love the fact that they're keeping this stuff alive, but as far as He-Man, like the other series that was on TV and, you know, the early 80s movie, it just wasn't He-Man.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't mind if they go and let's redo He-Man.
Yeah.
But let's make him the He-Man that millions of people already love. Let's not change him and hope we get another following.
Yeah.
With She-Ra, I even met the girl that plays Catra. She's a very nice girl, but I didn't care for the artwork. You know, it looks like having all my work taken to Japan and Korea back in the 80s doesn't make it any better that it's all done in Japanese style.
Yeah.
And so I thought the storyline and everything was fine. I just don't care for the artwork and the animation.
Yeah.
And the computer animation that they use is not hand-drawn stuff like we did, so it doesn't move as good.
Right.
Yeah. And but with the new movie, let's do He-Man.
Yes.
You know, let's put Orko in there.
Yes.
With the way they've got CG nowadays, imagine what they could make Snake Mountain look like.
Oh, man.
Oh, dude.
We talk about this all the time.
Yes.
It is. And it's like with what, you know, you watch like Lord of the Rings, you know, for example, and it's like, you can see what they can do. And that's been a while since they've had Lord of the Rings out, you know, and it's incredible what they can do. And it's like, you could explore Eternia and the whole, you know, Etheria and everything, all He-Man, all She-Ra to such a degree now with the computer technology that we have. It's like,
I just hearken back to Thor and what they did with Asgard.
Yep. I love the first Thor.
Yeah, and that's perfect. And that's the first thing I thought. And same thing with let's do a Thundar feature, man.
Yes. So, hey, as a fan of Spider-Man, are you enjoying some of these Spider-Man and other Marvel movies that are out?
Yeah, you know, the problem is they keep changing them too much from the original.
Yeah.
And I'm a fan of the original, so the fact that, look, the Spider-Man universe thing that they just did, my daughter and I went to see it just about a week or so ago, and I thought it was pretty good, but I don't want the Black Spider-Man, I don't want the Peter Parker old Spider-Man, there's too much of this, let's make 25 different Spider-Man so we can make more money. I just prefer the original.
Sure,
and I'm not against it, because I thought it was a fine movie. I thought it was well done. The animation was good. I had no problem with it. It's just that make it something else. Don't make it Spider-Man. But, of course, that's why they can make big bucks, because they're making about Spider-Man.
Right.
So, now, I don't know if you've been on my Facebook page, but I've got an interview that I did in Portland a couple months ago. And with Afternoon Live was the name of the TV show. And the interview is really good. It's about a 15-minute interview with this lady that's like super excited and really, really good at her job. I mean, she really made me feel comfortable. And at the end, I have a little flip book that I did of Spider-Man. That's the only time I've ever worked on Spider-Man was doing this little flip book.
Nice.
Yeah, so check out my Facebook page and come on out and send a friend request or whatever and you can look at it.
I think I actually just liked your page last night, as a matter of fact. I have not watched the interview, but I saw that it was posted on there, so I'll definitely be watching that soon.
And the other thing I wanted to say, that at one point, you know, Earl Norum?
Yes.
Okay, well, he did all those great paintings, right?
Yes.
Well, when I first started doing this, I contacted Earl, and I said, look, I've got an access to 5 or 6 of your really famous He-Man posters. And I said, I'm willing to, you know, spend the money to print them out. And if you'll allow me to sell them, I'll split the profit with you. And, you know, I called him up one morning. His phone number was in the book.
Oh, wow.
So I called him up and I asked him, I said, you know, I worked on this show and I'm looking for things that I can do that the fans are really going to love, that I can autograph, not saying that this is my artwork. You know, if I autograph the comic book from DC,
Right.
I tell people, I didn't do the artwork on this. And they say, we don't care. You worked on He-Man.
So yeah.
Sign my comic. So I told them the same thing. I said, look, I didn't, obviously, this beautiful painting of yours, I said, but I'd like to sell them. And I'll share the profit with you. And he said, look, he says, I am 92 years old.
Right.
And he said, I've made so much money off all this stuff. He says, I would be happy if you would just make sure you tell people that I did the artwork. And I said, believe me, everybody knows you did the artwork. And he said, I don't mind if you sell them. And, you know, have at it and good luck. Yeah. And so that's another thing that lent into this I'm selling other people's work thing.
Yeah.
It's like, I have the guy's permission.
Right.
Yeah.
And soon as he passed away, I stopped selling it because now I didn't have anybody else to corroborate, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of it too, it kind of comes down with music as well, which is still an art form. And you, especially nowadays, you have a lot of bands and stuff for recovering stuff from, you know, the 60s or 80s even or whatever and stuff like that. And it's like, you don't blink an eye when you hear a song that's been covered on a newer band now. You're like, oh, well, obviously they probably, you know, talk to that guy. They're getting royalties, whatever and stuff. But there's a backstory there, you know. I mean, the same would have to go with what you're talking about. You know, it's like they don't know the whole story. They don't realize that, hey, you call them up and talk to them and, you know, you have your discussions with the person and got it all lined out, you know. But I think people just instantly are like, oh, you know, it's like everybody's got a chip on their shoulder ready to attack, you know.
It's that thing where people just start saying things and then everybody jumps on board and nobody knows the real story.
Right. Right.
And I'm a good guy. I'm a nice guy. I give anybody that comes by my table or whatever, I give them free stuff. You know, I'm not this money grubbing, you know, I'm out there I want to make some money doing this at the cons, but most of my goal is to meet the fans and let them go away saying, my gosh, this was a great guy. And, you know, it's so like when this all came up, like, oh my gosh, you know, you're talking about one of the nice guys of the animation industry and they're making me out to be like Simon Legree. And it's like, geez,
right. You know?
Guys, hide your purses. He'll steal them.
Right. Well, I mean, to me, especially with the Motu Nation thing that you're talking about as well, which is too bad. But because like when I was following along with that for a while and like people were asking you some really cool questions and. I think there's even a point where like, I got to step away for a little bit. I'll be back in about an hour. Like if you're such a horrible person, like why in the world would you say, hey, I got to step away for a minute. I'll be back in an hour. You know, like you want to do that. You know, you're a good person. You actually care about people and it shows through all your actions.
Yeah. And I realize, you know, it's exciting to talk to somebody that worked on your show.
Yeah.
And you know, even when, I don't know if you know Chris, who's got all the cells that he's selling. Are you on the Evolution one too?
I don't believe
No, I don't think so.
Well, he has a bunch. Every week, he's got a bunch of cells that he's like kind of raffling off online. And that's where I'm doing the interview on Sunday.
Oh, exciting.
Okay. Is that site there. And it's going to be like a Facebook Live thing. So, yeah. So, you know, they... everything was going fine with answering questions. They were calling things and said, well, this is a panoramic cell. So I put on there, said, well, it's not a panoramic cell. It's a pan cell because it's going to pan, meaning that its background's going to move.
Right.
And they just assumed because the word was pan that it was short for panoramic.
Right.
And so it's little things like that where I could come in and chime in and correct some of the you know, the mythology or the terminology that they're talking about. And, you know, they're appreciative. It's like, oh my gosh, we didn't know that's what it meant. And then one of them, there was a W/O scene 138. And I said, well, that means it works out of scene 138. So the animator would go back to scene 138 and make sure that the very last pose is used in your new scene so that it doesn't jump when they cut. If He-Man's got his hands on his hips and then it cuts to the next scene and now his hands are at his side, it's going to jump.
Yeah.
So you have to be sure that He-Man's got his hands on his hips when you start your scene. And so it's little things like that that I can kind of help fill in some spaces for the people that are really interested in this stuff.
I love that you do that, Tom, because like I said, I was looking at some of your stuff on your Facebook page, and I saw like you've done panels before with comic conventions and stuff like that, and your panels go in very good detail. Like I saw a bunch of graph paper and all sorts of stuff of how they do this and the markings on the paper mean this, and like you go, sure. And it, what's cool about it is you do it in a way like what you're just talking about there. It's like you're touching on stuff that everybody that watch these shows is very interested in. They want to see that behind the scenes stuff. And like, I don't know if you've ever seen the book, The Art of Masters of the Universe. And and it's a fantastic book, and they did such a good job. But I really think that they could have made that book about 8 foot tall with as many of the little things in intricate detail, especially like what you go into detail with, that, you know, it just adds so much more to it.
Well, and see, you know, I noticed because, you know, I'm sure you've seen The Toys That Made Us.
Yes.
Yep.
And they didn't talk to any animators. They talked to the story guys, you know, maybe a storyboard artist, but nobody that actually sat and drew the thing.
Yeah.
And it was a little disconcerting to me. I wish they would have talked to somebody, even if it wasn't me. I mean, there's plenty of animators that they could talk to.
Right.
But that's what I do in my panel, is at one point I go through all the things I've told you about how I got started. And then I go, the last bit is step by step how the cartoon was made. Each department, what they were responsible for. It's really complicated and people don't understand. You know, with those panning backgrounds, as an animator, you had to figure out when you saw the character walking, how much distance was for each step and each drawing. And you had to make the background move. So it might move 0.068 inches per frame.
That's incredible.
And you had to figure all that stuff out, you know, and thankfully we had calculators, but it's still, if you didn't have a math inclination, it was really difficult for you. And we had people that would say, hey, Tom, can you help me with this? I'm trying to get this guy to, because otherwise it looks like they're ice skating on the background.
Yeah, right. That's true. They'd be like surfing.
Yep.
When their first foot comes down, when the foot starts moving back, it has to stay in exactly the same place on the background until it lifts up.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's that people don't think about that. That's part of animating. You have to keep track of these things so that it can look as real as possible.
See, you brought up The Toys That Made Us, and you bring up a solid point that, you know, I did like the episode. It was a little salty at times, but the thing was, is that you're right though. I would agree with you that I would have much rather heard from the animators, probably, other than the people who write the stories, because when I think back to He-Man and stuff, and I've even watched a lot of the episodes that was recent, and it's hard for me to remember what the actual storylines were. I remember how intricate the details of the cartoon was and the voices and stuff like that. So like I'm not drawing the story on a piece of paper as a kid. I'm drawing what I saw and I'm drawing the animation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I always kid Alan Oppenheimer, you know, because he gets to be over in the celebrity section and the people are coming up. Oh my gosh. And he charges like three times what I charge for autographs.
Right.
And I always tell him, I said, Alan, without me, you are radio.
Exactly. It's true.
That's great.
Oh, man. Although I will say the episode Too Many Skeletors is writing gold.
That is. It was really good.
A bunch of tiny skeletons.
I mean, the thing is, every department was just as important as the next. Because if you missed any one of those things, the show wasn't going to be as good.
Right.
And obviously, if there's nothing animated, then it is a radio program, which still could be good. You know, it's not like, but it's just a way to kind of get under Alan's skin. I always tell him, I said, Alan, I can do voices. Can you draw?
Shots fired. That's funny.
He's a good guy. He's like 88 years old now, and he's just, he's got a really great sense of humor, and I just love him to death. And we're going to be, I think we're in Garden State Con in New Jersey that same weekend of the Omaha one that you're talking about.
Exciting.
And we're there, and I was in Vegas a couple weeks ago with him, and we always have a good time.
I really hope that we can get him close by, if not to Omaha at some point, because it, you know, it's been a dream of mine to meet Alan, because I, again, like you said, I've never met him, but he's a great guy. I've been following him for a while. Skeletor is my favorite guy from the cartoons. Such an iconic voice. But yeah.
He's got a nice agent that, is really taken care of now. He had trouble at first because people just weren't pitching him enough. And now he can go just about anywhere he wants. And so he's pretty picky about where he goes because he doesn't like if it's too long a flight or, you know, right. But he'll get a guarantee. You know, he wants a guarantee. Well, that way, I know in Vegas, for some reason, the crowd just wasn't really into the voice artists. And they had quite a few voice artists there.
Weird.
So I don't think he made his guarantee, which is strange because, gosh, he'd be the first one I'd go to practically because he's got so many different voices he's done. Plus, I mean, he was in Gunsmoke and, you know, everything.
We had Rob Paulson, familiar with him. Pinky and the Brain and, oh my gosh, Newton Turtles. And oh my gosh, he had a line of people like out the door. Yeah. He's such a great guy too.
I've met him before. That was one of the few things that I didn't get to work on was Pinky and the Brain. I wanted to, directing thing for Warner Brothers called Road Rovers, and it was at the same time of Pinky and the Brain, and I called up the guys and I said, hey, can I just do one episode? And they said, you know what, we don't want to send that out because they had to ship it to Seattle. And they said, that's one show we just want to keep in-house. It's like, crap, I would love to have worked on Pinky and the Brain.
That would have been fun.
That would have been. So we got a couple questions for you.
Yeah.
Were you when they relaunched the He-Man cartoon in the early 2000s, were you approached or contacted, or did you serve as a consultant, or was there anything about that when it had started you had any involvement with?
No.
That's unfortunate.
Because I would have told them don't change it so much.
Yeah.
You know. But no, I mean really, from 1990, when I moved away to Seattle, I really didn't do any more animation work. It was all directing.
Yeah.
And occasionally, I would get work. I had an animator friend of mine, and that whenever he got work, he liked when I was an assistant, I was a really good key assistant, which means going in and really fixing up drawings that aren't that good. And making them look really, really spot on with what the character is supposed to look like.
Yeah.
So he liked my work, and he said, look, anytime I get work, I'm going to have you clean my drawings up. So I'm going to send the work to you in Seattle.
Okay.
And he was true to his word. I mean, I got to work on Thumbelina, We're Back, the dinosaur story, and a few other things like that. Just due to him insisting that I was the one that cleaned up his drawings.
Nice.
Yeah. And I also worked, there was a movie called Stay Tuned with John Ritter and Pam Dauber. And at one point, they get turned into cartoon mice, and Chuck Jones did all the, this little sequence, and I did all of the cleanup on the Chuck Jones scene.
Oh, nice.
And they actually called me up. Chuck called me up after we were done, and he said, look, I'd like to have lunch with you tomorrow because we want you to head up our assistant animation department. And I said, gosh, that makes me feel really good. I mean, this is Chuck freaking Jones, okay? I mean, this is the guy, the Roadrunner and all that stuff. And he's asking for me to be the head of his assistant department. And I said, but I don't think you realize you've called Seattle. I live in Seattle. And he goes, oh, man, we need you to be down here in the studio down here in L.A. And I said, you know, I'm so honored that you've asked me, but I really don't want to move back to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So But it was still awful nice to be asked by Chuck Jones.
Man. I noticed, I mean, not noticed, we were going through the laundry list of cartoons you had worked on. I saw you also worked, at least, you know, from what we saw on your IMDb, you worked on the Filmation Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, I don't know if you want to share anything with that at all, like, because that was the Ghostbusters that was from kind of the original black and white,
right,
with the monkey.
That was a big, huge controversy for a long time because everybody thought Filmation, this is what we're talking about. Okay, this is what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Filmation ripped off Ghostbusters.
Right.
They're ruining, you know, Ghostbusters. It's like, no. Dan Aykroyd wanted the name his movie Ghostbusters, but we had the right to the name Ghostbusters. So
right.
They had to come to and buy the right to use the name.
Right.
And so everybody thought Filmation was a ripoff studio and all this sort of stuff. It's like, no, we were the first ones to have it. And the live action show that was on TV, it was their kids that were the cartoon. So in other words, the two characters and the monkey sold the Ghostbuster, you know, franchise, whatever you want to call it, to
right.
their kids. And that was the cartoon at part.
Yes.
And the cool thing about the Ghostbusters cartoon was, and I'm glad you asked, is that there's this whole sequence where they go, let's go Ghostbusters. And they do a high five between all of them.
Yeah.
And then they get in this elevator and it moves them through this really strange world.
Yep.
And they, all these machines are picking them up and putting their clothing on, and they throw them up against this little spider web type of thing. And then Eddie has got these underwear on with hearts on them, and he's kind of embarrassed that he's in his underwear. That whole sequence was done by me and my friend Mike Toth.
Oh, how fun.
And that showed, you know, twice an episode for every single episode of that show.
Yes.
So it was always a really cool thing to know that we had done that entire sequence.
How fun.
And it was kind of a little in our cap, you know, that we did the main sequence that was shown over and over and over.
Really. Yeah. You know, the funny irony of that was I grew up on military bases growing up, moved around quite a bit. And sometimes you were just stuck with what was ever on TV. And this is before cable TV became kind of a thing, like more readily available. And I remember watching the old black and white Ghostbusters with the monkey from like, I think it was like the 50s.
And, no, it was in 74.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, 74.
Okay. Yeah. But it was two guys and this gorilla.
Yeah.
And then when the movies came out in the 80s, I'm like, is this Ghostbuster? Like, I was confused with the actual Dan Aykroyd. So it's still great stuff, and I'm not knocking it. But
I loved it. But you were one of those guys actually knew that there was something before Dan Aykroyd. But most people didn't see that.
Yeah.
So it confused the crap out of everybody.
Yeah, no, I can see it, but yeah, I was in with the monkey from ground from day one.
Like, and I directed the Extreme Ghostbusters, which was the first time that they had like a handicapped. He was in a wheelchair as one of the Ghostbusters, and so I got to do that. So I've worked on both of the Ghostbusters as far as, you know, the main characters from the movie, and I also did my animation work on Slimer.
Wow.
A lot of this stuff was like done freelance work.
Yeah.
So a lot of it, I don't get credit on the IMDb page because if you weren't an animator, first off, they usually don't put you down in the credits.
Yeah.
So sometimes as an animator, if you didn't do enough animation, they wouldn't give you credit even though you animated on it.
Weird.
Like, I don't know if you've seen the movie Rover Dangerfield, but I did animation on that, but I mainly did key assistant animation. And even though I did animation on it, they said, well, you didn't do enough footage is what they go by. You didn't do enough feet of animation to be able to be made as an animator. So I'm just put in there as an assistant animator.
I see.
But, you know, there's lots of rules and regulations and, for a long time, they wouldn't give me credit for Super Friends because that's the very first thing I kind of worked on. But I was an assistant, and in the credits, they don't give the assistant animators any credit. So I finally I finally convinced them that I worked on it. But then if you go to my IMDb page, they have the wrong Super Friends. I worked on the one in 78-79, yeah. Challenge of Super Friends, and they have me on the 1984 one. So I'm trying to fix that. But there's a number of things that I did work on that I just can't get credit for because they just said, well, there's no proof that you worked on it.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I've got drawings from it if you want me to show you, because I kept every drawing that I've ever done practically. So I've got stacks and stacks of drawings if they want proof that I actually worked on it. And anything that I worked on that I liked, especially when I was assistant, that I could learn from, I would Xerox the entire scene when it was completed. And so I've got like little flip books of all these different things from Super Friends and, you know, certain things that looked really cool that I worked on that later on I thought, well, if I ever have to do something like this, this would be great reference to be able to see what this animator did to make this work this way.
Wow.
And so you're constantly looking at other animation and taking what you can from it to learn for yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
And otherwise you can't grow.
So out of your large catalog of all the different shows that you worked on, what would you say was A, your favorite to work on, and B, probably your most iconic?
Yeah, obviously I think the most iconic would be He-Man. Right. Yeah, that's huge everywhere. I mean, they brought me into Dubai. Do you know where Dubai is?
Yes.
Yes.
It's a long freaking way from here, and
it's not Los Angeles.
I had the sheiks coming up to me, you know, in their little sheets and everything. This is the greatest show I ever see in my world. It's He-Man.
Oh wow!
and it was so. Gosh, you're kidding me! In Mexico City and Ecuador, this year I'm going to Chile.
Yeah.
And so that was a show that was all around the world. So, I mean, it's huge.
Yeah.
As far as the shows that I loved working on, of course, we've talked about Thundar. That's my favorite thing probably that I've worked on.
Yeah.
Movie-wise, it would have been, we worked on the Tummy Trouble Roger Rabbit short.
Yes. Yes.
I got that job there. So working on Roger Rabbit was really great because I loved the original movie so much. Yeah. And I also got to work on The Prince and the Pauper, which is Mickey Mouse and Donald and Goofy.
Yep.
And everybody worth his salt wants to work on Mickey because, of course, he was the first, you know, real animated character that hit it big. So, but any of the other ones, I mean, Scooby-Doo, I mean, come on, it's Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that one that the fans, usually families of all ages know Scooby-Doo. With He-Man, if you're a 10-year-old kid, unless your dad introduced it to you, you have no idea what He-Man is.
Right. But
everybody knows who Scooby-Doo is.
Yeah.
So that's a huge one, too.
Yeah.
The only thing I get questioned every now and then is, what did you not like to work on? And the one thing I didn't like to work on had nothing to do with the show or the characters, was the Smurfs.
Really? Oh,
really?
And the reason I didn't like it is because every episode or every scene that we worked on, there's 3, 4, 5, 6 Smurfs in it.
Yeah.
So you're doing 6 times the animation because each one of those characters has to move. So it was like, if you got a scene, like I had a scene with 3 Smurfs on each side of a tug of war. That's 6 Smurfs pulling back and forth. Man, it took forever to get done. And we're under the gun for how many feet of film we did per week. So luckily, if you had a really tough scene like that, the directors would feed you something like maybe just the opening sequence where the camera's just panning in to show you the building that you're going to be going into and there's no animation. But you could get credit for that footage and add it to your weekly footage. And that way, even if you had a really tough scene, one of the toughest scenes I ever had was in the Godzilla cartoon. And this is the Hanna-Barbera Godzilla with Godzuki. And there is this 6-armed Aztec statue that comes to life. And Godzilla and he are wrestling on the ground. And it was the full size of a piece of paper. So, I mean, they were gigantic. So what we talk about in the business is pencil mileage. And that is how far your pencil has to go to do a drawing. Because if you do a little small drawing, you can do it really quickly. Right. But if it's the entire page, it takes you forever to get it done. So I think I did 12 drawings, and it took me an entire week.
Wow.
Just because it was so complicated. That's one that I needed to get some padding to my footage for the week.
Yeah.
It came out good, but it was still like, man, that's a lot of work.
You turn in your pages, you're like, this is all I got. Leave me alone.
Yeah, exactly.
So how many actual drawings does it take per second? Is it like 15 or something like that? Or
it's 12 drawings per second.
That's what I thought, yeah.
What?
It's 24 frames per second.
Oh, that was
film runs at 24 frames, and each one of the cells is photographed twice.
Yeah.
So it's called shooting it on twos. If something is moving really fast, you shoot it on ones, just because if it's shot on twos, it looks like it disappears and pops forward instead of actually moving forward.
Yeah.
So you would shoot each individual frame and make it move each one of those frames. But that's only when something was really, really moving fast.
Right.
Because even Disney films were like 12 frames a second, you know, because it looked, to the human eye, it didn't look any different.
Yeah.
The twist was, now with video, it's 30 frames a second. It's a different speed. So when I first worked at Microsoft and I was doing the animation up there on videos, I noticed that when I get something done, it moved a little too fast. And then it suddenly dawned on me, because I've got 6 extra frames.
Mm-hmm.
Every scene I did, I had to be sure to add 2, 3, 4 frames to it to make sure that it moved at the correct speed.
That's insane.
That is insane.
You just figure how many drawings.
Yeah, so if you think about it, like a 2-hour cartoon movie would be about almost 175,000 drawings.
Yeah. That's a lot.
And so you're talking 65 episodes per season of He-Man. At 22 minutes apiece, that's a lot.
Yeah, 52 weeks in a year. Remember that. So 52 weeks, and you have 65 episodes. So that's 13 more episodes than there are weeks.
That's incredible.
It's almost like a episode and a quarter every week. Well, that's why we didn't really touch on this, but that's one of the reasons why in He-Man you'll see they reuse the same animation.
Yeah.
In order to get our budgets low enough to compete with Japan and Korea, we had to find a way to save money. And the way to do it is, we did a bunch of really good, well-drawn scenes, some of it even rotoscoped, of characters running. And they would run diagonally, they'd run toward the camera, away from the camera, side to side. And that way, anytime somebody had to go somewhere, they could just take off running.
Right.
And everything was drawn.
Right.
And we got criticized for it, but obviously, if we didn't do that, we would have been out of business. So, but we made sure that the drawings were, I mean, those runs were beautiful. I mean, they were right taken from humans that were running. You know, we really did a good job on them.
Oh, the movement was gorgeous. I read somewhere, somebody had attributed part of the success of the He-Man cartoon to the fact that you guys had reused key animations, because kids like, they need and they enjoy repetition.
Right.
And that seeing the character move in a way that they are familiar with gives them a sense of kind of stability, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And then they would also think, oh, there's that cool scene again.
There's that move. You know? Yeah.
Exactly. That was Andy Mangels.
Yes. That's what Andy Mangels told us.
Yep.
And you know what's funny?
Yeah. Well, Andy too. Yeah, I've spoken with Andy a number of times. He's a good guy. Yeah. Now, we also, one of the things that I, let's see if I can remember what I was just going to talk about. They would do dailies, what's called dailies. Every day, whatever was filmed on the animation camera would be shown to Lou in our little studio that we had at the studio, a little, screen and everything. And that way he would look and find any mistakes or whatever and see how well the show is coming along. Well, the animators in different shifts would be allowed to, like, maybe go in on Monday or Friday or whatever, and then the next animators would go on Tuesday, because they didn't want every animator going every day, because then production stops. But Lou would look at a scene and he'd say, hey, that is a good scene right there. So every time He-Man fights against Beast-Man, let's find a way to use that scene. And they would reuse the animation, but they would put a different background with it. And so that way you get a little feather in your cap for doing a good show, you know, because he would always say, hey, who animated that one? And, you know, one of them was my scene with Beast-Man. And I just wave my hand and go, oh, good job, Tom. The scene that I did, and it's kind of cool. I've got five or six cells of this scene that I found over the years, is Beast-Man in one scene has got his whip and he whips off stage, and then you cut, and then He-Man's standing there and he sees the whip come in and he grabs the whip.
Yeah.
And then he pulls Beast-Man into the scene and swings him around and throws him off stage.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yep. That's awesome.
Exactly. So now what they would do is maybe do a close-up of that and change the background. And then it was, or flip the animation and he pulls him in from the other side and flings him off the other side. And so there's all sorts of ways to make that look like a new scene, even though it was being reused. And I had actually, that's at one of the shows, you know, people come up and they want me to sign cells. And you know, I always tell them, I say, look, that's not a cell that I drew. It's really hard to find cells that I drew because there's millions of them. Yeah. But one day some guy came up and he had a cell from that sequence I was just talking about. And I'm going, oh my gosh, that's my drawing.
Right.
Yeah. And he goes, well, he said, I would give it to you, except I want it.
That's right.
so I signed it for him and I went on eBay and I found five more cells from that same sequence, and I bought them all.
Nice.
Oh, wow. So that's one of the few sequences that I have of cells. I've got a lot of the drawings, but it's still nice to have my cells, and it's even got the original background with it, which is really nice.
That is nice.
But it blows my mind that studios, and I guess when they go out, they sell this stuff, but it just kills me that it's weird to see that this stuff's just open for sale. You know, not that I'm complaining, but it's just kind of a weird thing to wrap your head around, you know?
Like, well, I mean, what happened early on is we would every now and then get an announcement saying, hey, we're throwing a bunch of cells away. Go out to the dumpster and back before we put them in there and you can grab some.
Jeez. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got all those Scooby-Doos I was telling you I was selling when I got that interview in the newspaper. And because, you know, I draw it, I hand it in, I never see it again. So, I mean, people always, oh, don't you have all the cells that you worked on? No, those weren't mine.
Yeah.
And so they put them in a warehouse, and then somebody bought the warehouse from Lou Scheimer.
Yeah.
And that's how they got all the cells. And then throughout the years, people have bought different chunks of them.
Yep.
You know, I had some guy come up to me, and he goes, like, I've got probably 200 cells here. And I can't sell them because I didn't draw anything. So people don't want them.
Right.
But maybe you can use them. And so I gave him like, you know, $150 or something for these 200 cells. And some of them are kind of useless, but many of them were very good. He-Man, you know, Beast-Man. I've got Evil Lyn.
Yeah.
And this way I can sell them and sign them. And that makes it so that I can sell them because the guy that had them had nothing to do with He-Man, so it was no big deal, you know. So people want to buy it from somebody who actually worked on the show.
Right. Yep.
That is something else.
But, So and like I said, I loved this all so much, and I've got so many things. I mean, right now I'm standing. I mean, can you hear this?
Yes.
That's my He-Man. That? That's my animation disc from when I worked on He-Man.
Oh, man.
He just touched the thing that he made He-Man on.
Yay. And I've got my whole setup. I've got the He-Man desk. I've got the shelving unit that I had above it. And I've got the little overhead lamp that I worked on. And this was, you know, He-Man, Brave Star, everything. I worked on this stuff. And when Filmation went under, they put everything up for sale. So I just said, hey, I want to buy all this stuff. So I think it cost me $75 for all this stuff.
That's incredible.
Not that you want random strangers through your home, but you should like charge a premium for people to come and just like
touch your desk.
Yeah, and Eddie and I would be first in line.
See, that's what's so cool. Is this? Look, again, I was so fortunate to work on this stuff. You know, it was just such a dream come true. And I mean, when I got married at about 38, and I was pretty much done with the animation part of my career, and I was just doing directing. So she never saw me go to the studio and do the drawings, and you know, she never saw that before. And she came with me to one of the conventions, and she's sitting there behind me, and some fan comes up and he goes, "Oh, Mr. Cook, you're a legend." And she starts laughing.
Oh.
And so I did too. I said, "You know, sir, Stan Lee is a legend, okay? He-Man is the legend. I'm just the animator on He-Man. Now, if you want to put me in that legend category, you know, fine, but I don't think I'm a legend."
That's it.
But so for the rest of the week, it was like my wife, "Hey, legend, dinner's ready."
Still, you got to help create a thing that touched so many people's lives. I mean,
and now you got random guys making podcasts about it that are calling you up and wanting you on their show. So,
right.
And like, believe me, I just don't take anything for granted. I just love it so much. And to be able to share this stuff with, you know, true fans is just, it's what I would want people that I meet to do for me as a fan. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yep.
And
it's so good that you put that out into the world like that, because Andy Mangles is like that as well. He's very much fan focused, and I think a lot of people are, but it's just so good to see that you care so much about the fans and showing what you did and actually like realizing that this means a lot to people like me and Eddie, and you fully embrace that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. And Andy was, you know, he wrote that Filmation book, and, well, I don't know if you have it, but man, I would buy it and read it. It's so good. It goes through every single series that they ever did at Filmation, kind of the what spawned it and what happened during it. And it was just, you know, I worked there for most of the book, but it still was interesting to know some of the things that I didn't know was going on behind the scenes, even being there, because I wasn't in Lou's office, you know.
Right.
And, we got two copies.
Okay. Yeah, Eddie and I both have a copy signed by
Absolutely.
Andy.
Absolutely. It's just terrific. I sat down and read it in one day. I mean, I just couldn't put it down.
It's really good.
And actually trying to, people have asked me, you know, write a book. So I've kind of been putting down, when the mood suits me, I start writing stuff and going through a lot of what we talked about and a little bit more detail of, as a kid, and then when I was a bus driver, some of the incidents that happened on the bus really don't have anything to do with animation, but have to do with what formed me as a human.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'll ever get it published. I'd love to at some point, you know, just self-publish it. And it's just exactly this, just sharing stories of things that happened to me. And you know, with the final line being, I was the most fortunate guy on the planet that I got to do this.
That's excellent.
Make the book, man.
Yeah, I think it'd be flying off the shelf, that's for sure.
If you need help, let us know. We'll do whatever it takes.
Well, you got to sit me down and make me write it all, because I go in chapter at a time, you know, and I'm even going through right now. I went out online and I got a bunch of pictures of the people that I worked with.
Yeah.
Because some of them are real characters. I mean, really fun people to work with. And, you know, I was at one point the coach of the Filmation softball team.
Oh, wow.
So I had a connection with a lot of the people, because if you worked in animation, the whole part of the building, it's just all animators. And that's who you get to know. And that's who you got to lunch with. I never knew any of the cameramen. And I never knew any of the layout guys, but all of a sudden they're joining the softball team. So now I knew the vice president in charge of signing our paychecks, because he was on our team.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I knew some of the directors, and I knew the guy that just handed out the stationery and art supplies. They all were on the softball team. And so it was really a fun thing. We just had a reunion, a 30-year reunion since the closing of Filmation.
Oh, man.
February 3rd, which, interesting enough, I mean, February 3rd is the day that Filmation closed. You know, I don't know if you know the story about Westinghouse owning us, and Westinghouse needed some money, so they decided to sell Filmation to be able to get some cash. And they promised Lou that they would sell to a company that was going to keep the studio open.
Oh.
And then L'Oreal, the makeup company, was interested, and they bought the company. And it was a Friday, February 3rd. And all of a sudden, we hear over the speaker system, there's an all-company meeting in the cafeteria. We never have all-company meetings.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
And I said, this is it. They're going to close the studio. And everybody said, no, they wouldn't do that, because we're working on two series. We're working on something called Bugsburg and something called Bravo, which was a spinoff from Bravestar.
Okay.
And we had like two or three episodes in the can, and all of a sudden we're having this company meeting. I said, no. I said, you don't understand. I just heard there's a new law going into effect in the United States that goes into effect on Monday, that if you lay off more than 70 people, you have to pay them 2 months' salary.
Right.
And they're going to be laying off 800 plus people.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So I said, they're closing it today because it's the last day they can.
Yeah.
And sure enough, we go up there and Lou is like in tears and he's apologizing. And we gave him a standing ovation.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Because we knew what he did for us.
Yeah.
And it wasn't his fault. They lied to him. They told him they were going to keep the studio open. And we took out a 2-page ad in the Hollywood Reporter, which is a magazine in Southern California. And it was 2 pages of all of us, all our names, just thanking him. And it's in the Andy Mangles book. It's around page. If you look at page 200, right around 210 or right in there. Of names, and it's everybody that worked there, and you'll see my name down there under the C's. And so that's kind of what destroyed Filmation. And the ironic thing is, February 3rd is the day the animation died, right?
Right.
Well, February 3rd is the day that Buddy Holly died, that they called the day the music died.
Oh man.
I've never hated a date so much in my life.
That's my mom's birthday. I hate the rot of her face in it.
I hate your mom's birthday now.
Well, we had a reunion this last February. I hadn't seen anybody in like these 30 years. And I flew down just to go to this reunion for one day. And we just met at a restaurant and had dinner together. And you know, a lot of the cameramen were there. Robbie London, one of the head writers, was there. That guy that I told you was the guy signing our paychecks, he was there. Erica Scheimer was there, Lou's daughter. And we had just a great time and a good dinner and, you know, talking and taking pictures. And, you know, there's some stuff on my Facebook, too, with pictures of them. And I'm going to probably share some of this at the interview that I do on Sunday.
Nice.
And I think that'll be posted on the MOTU Evolution site.
Okay.
You can get hooked up with that. You'll be able to see some of those.
Nice.
Yeah, the guy that's interviewing me is in London.
Oh, wow.
So it's like an 8-hour difference. So I think we're doing the interview at like 1:30 our time. Well, my time.
Yeah.
In Pacific. And that's like, you know, like 9 at night or something his time. So. but yeah, check it out. I'm sure we're going to hit a lot of the stuff that we're talking about now. But since this is going to be video, I'm hoping I can take my phone around and take some pictures of like the statues I've got and show you my He-Man desk and that sort of stuff.
That's cool.
Well, hey, we'll like your page and we'll send you how to get a hold of us. And if you'd like, you could send us any photos. We could add it to the episode as well.
Yeah. Sure. Fun. Sure. And again, anytime. I mean, because we could go another 6 hours.
Oh yeah.
That'd be fun.
We'll call this the first interview with Tom Cook.
Yeah, and do that because I would love to do it again. It's been fun.
Well, that's awesome, Tom. Well, if you wouldn't mind, tell our listeners how they can, because you said you do commission work and stuff like that. How can they get a hold of you to do that sort of thing?
Basically, I have a Facebook page, which is Tom Cook Animator. If you do that, it usually pops up. You can also, you know, contact me through there. I had a website. but it's been up for so long that the technology, they don't support it anymore. So I have to redo my entire website. So that's kind of down right now. But if you contact me at 80sanimator@gmail.com, which is just 80sanimator, I'm sure there aren't too many people that have the email 80sanimator.
Sure.
And even though I was also a 90s animator and a late 70s animator, but I thought 80s was good enough. And so you can contact me there and we can just talk about, you know, whatever you'd like to have drawn. And like I said, I've got price points starting at $60 and get up to $400. Just depends on what you want. Do everything in color because I use Copic markers. And like I said earlier, I want it to kind of look like you've got a cell, but it's hand drawn. So I make sure it's got color. But instead of a cell, I actually shadows and stuff too. So it's a little bit more 3D looking.
Nice.
And then if you've got PayPal, that's usually the way I get paid, is just use the friends and family PayPal.
Yeah.
Yep.
Very good.
Yep. I just liked your page. So there you go.
Well, yeah. Cool, Tom. Well, hey, it's been such a pleasure getting to know you a lot better. You've been fantastic. And I'm sure our listeners are going to love this episode as much as we had a good time doing this with you. And hopefully this is our first of many episodes with you. So.
Yep. Sounds good.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks again for your time, Tom. And yep. Until next time, good journey. Mega.